Edgish Heads, another one. This one, well, this one's been a while. I first spoke to my guest today, I think 12 years ago, when we actually did a sort of podcast before podcasting back at the old dish. We called it Deep Dish, we did at the time, one of our more brilliant puns. Everything's about a pizza, basically. Anyway, we did a conversation with my current guest, which was really rewarding and interesting. And I've been thinking about him and reading him ever since. And there is a book he's just put out, which is an interesting book. Anyway, his name is Christian Wyman. He's a poet and an author, a writer, a lecturer. He served as the editor of Poetry Magazine itself from 2003 to 2013. And he has written in places like The Atlantic, Harper's, the New York Times Book Review, The New Yorker, and others. And he's the author, editor, and translator of more than a dozen books. But his new one is called Zero at the Bone, 50 Entries Against Despair. And it's very hard. This is probably going to be one of the hardest podcast I've ever done, because it covers so much ground, and it also does it in a non-systematic way. There are 50 different parts of this book. Some of them are just single poems. Some of them are reflections. Some of them are quite developed essays. Some of them are memoirs. And they grapple with the big questions, the question of faith and unfaith, the question of suffering, the question of what and if there is an ultimate meaning to this universe, and Christian's own faith, his Christian faith, which emerges in ways that I think you will find extremely modern and also extremely frank and extremely in touch with the awfulness of reality, as it often happens. Those are my very rough impressions of the book, but I hope we'll talk about bits of them. And it's also written, as one might expect from someone who cares this much about words, really beautifully. And the prose has a kind of poetic quality to it. And unlike a lot of spiritual writing or religious writing, it's not that spiritual or religious in many senses. It's just real. And it comes from a very real life, a very modern life too, which is the other thing I'd like to stress before we start, that this is not a Christian or a person of faith who is unaware of what the modern world is or hasn't encountered it directly, hasn't lived through its doubts and darknesses as well as its joys. And that makes this a really complicated and interesting. I keep coming back to bits of it in a way that I used to ponder and go back to Pascal, the Pensée, which is equally an attempt to explain, talk about Christianity, but not in a systematic way. Because in a sense, you can't do it systematically and be true to the subject matter that you're talking about, because there is something mysterious at the heart of it, something ineffable, that doesn't reveal itself systematically, as it were. Anyway, that's a long way around of saying, welcome, Christian, to the Dishcast. It is an honor to have you again. And I'm so glad you're thriving, and I'm incredibly grateful for the book.
Oh, it's great to be back, Andrew, after all these years. I think last time it was in a tiny apartment in the village.
It was. I used to live in a shoebox in the West Village for a grim and awful year with no sunlight, as I recall, basically. Which is, tell me about where you grew up. Obviously, it plays an enormous part in your writing and your poetry, and it has a very clear geographic sense of the place, as well as a family that is very much part of your life, and yet also that you grew apart from at some points in your life as well. Tell us about where you grew up and who your mom and dad were.
Yeah, I grew up in West Texas, a little town called Snyder. We moved there when I was a kid, probably 8 or 9. My father had been a Bible salesman and a vacuum cleaner salesman before that, and drove a bus for a while, and finally got his act together and went to medical school, and then returned to Snyder, where he was from, to start a family practice. And so we'd been very, very poor. and then in relative terms became wealthy. I mean, for that little town, it was wealthy. And my mother and father had been together since they were in high school. My mother's parents died when she was 14. Her father shot her mother and then shot himself in front of her. And so she had quite a difficult adolescence. That happened when she was 14. And she moved from place to place and family to family. And that event really has defined her life and in some ways defined our lives too, because there was never a time when we didn't know about it. It wasn't a secret. And it was just part of the air we grew up in. And my father was a very intelligent person, but also very combustible, tempestuous, and pretty mad. And the number of things that he did when I was growing up, from crashing cars, crashing motorhomes, crashing airplanes, to one addiction after another, until finally he was out of the picture when I was a teenager. It was a pretty crazy upbringing. Although people say that, you know, I tell them I'm at Yale now, and I meet people who can't believe that a poet comes from Snyder, Texas. And in retrospect, it seems to me a very good place to be raised as a poet. I didn't have any books but in the house, but I had stories. And also there was just a kind of intensity that made me hungry for forms to put it in.
You mean the landscape itself, this sort of the barrenness of a lot of it, was something that you kind of wanted to fill in some way? Or
that, but also the people of the place, who often seemed like they're kind of animate instances of the landscape. They're so crabbed and thorned and tough themselves and silent. And yeah, coming out of all that, when I discovered poetry in college, it was like I'd been thrown a rescue rope. I had somewhere to put all of that anger, really, and feeling.
Anger at what?
Anger at that background. Anger at the loss of God. That happened to me pretty quickly when I left that place. Anger at my father, certainly. And then just, I think some people are born angry. I think I might have come out of the womb with a little chip on my shoulder. Yeah.
The silences of Texas. And silence is a theme throughout a lot of your writing. And of course, it's the silences in poetry, or the way the poetry leaves you sometimes with a silence at the end of it, or in the middle of it, or in some way the pauses of it. I think you have this beautiful quote from Dickinson, Emily Dickinson. You say that Dickinson's dashes, you know, where she puts these dashes into her poetry, pushes the language apart to open up the space where we live without language, which is obviously what Dickinson does in this incredible way. And you have to complete the thought. You have to enter into the poem to make it make sense. So it's this collaborative venture, and the collaboration is often around what those silences mean, what they point to.
Yeah, she also has a great quatrain. I can't quite, I think it's as if heaven were a bell and being but an ear and eye and silence wrecked solitary here, which I think is wonderful. She can silence there. All being is but an ear and eye and silence wrecked solitary here. But yeah, I definitely grew up with that sense of silence as both a pressuring force and a releasing force, which I think you get in that poem by Dickinson.
Yes. There's one point, because sometimes these insights in the book are just worth quoting, and you forgive me, readers and listeners, and you, Christian, if I quote you, because there are some ways that you put these things that really affected me. Here is one, and this is really about the nature of what faith means in the face of that kind of silence. Quote, "One doesn't follow God in the hope of happiness, but because one senses, miserable, flimsy little word for that beak in your bowels, a truth that renders ordinary contentment irrelevant. There are some hungers that only an endless commitment to emptiness can feed. The only true antidote to the plague of modern despair is an absolute and perhaps even annihilating awe. Is that kind of what you felt in the face of that landscape as a boy? Because you also talk about these incredibly dark periods when you were a boy, loneliness and depression. And it's not that God is an attempt to overcome that. It's a sense that you sense God in that.
Yeah, that's very true. That passage ends with a quote from Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish theologian. I asked for wonders instead of happiness, Lord, and you gave them to me, which I think summarizes that whole thought. I wrote that once when there was a TV show, and I was watching someone was talking about the relation between depression and religion, there being a relation. And yeah, it occurred to me that faith for me is much like poetry in that it provides awe rather than happiness. That it's not a kind of contentment that you're going to get out of it, but something more valuable than contentment. Heschel also said that he thought that the basis of all religion should be awe, not doubt, that all true knowledge begins in awe and not in doubt. And I think that's a good way. It's a very difficult way for us to think these days, because all of the momentum of the time is against. But as we're trained to be such critical thinkers and to question everything so adamantly that it's difficult for us to go the other direction and be open to awe, be open to joy.
And yet I think that's quite a common modern experience, awe, actually, that you do feel at times in the context of a landscape, a beautiful morning. So, I mean, I feel it all the time. I mean, one of the reasons I go and live at the end of Cape Cod for a lot of the year is that the awe I feel in the presence of that kind of nature and that kind of beauty. And I think that a lot of non-Christians, non-people who don't believe, a lot of listeners to this show will have experienced that too, but don't see that, and sometimes see that as a kind of, wow, the universe is amazing, that kind of thing. You're dancing the last dance as the sun comes up at Burning Man, and you see these beautiful mountains in the distance and you are in awe of it, but they don't then see that as an entry point for faith of any kind.
That always confuses me.
Yeah.
That always confuses me. I'd actually did a whole anthology called Joy, 100 Poems. And I did it after reading an essay by Zadie Smith called Joy in the New York Review of Books. And she talked about she was drawing a distinction between joy and pleasure. And she says that she's a person of pleasure. She loves pineapple popsicles and she loves basically all kinds of food. And she and her husband, who's a poet, have this thing where they collect faces during the day and then they tell each other the stories of the faces that they've seen. You know, it's nice. But then she says, she puts that up against experiences of joy in her life. And she says that she's had like five or six, I can't remember what it was. And she means intense experiences of joy along the lines of C.S. Lewis, you know, surprised by joy, these moments that really knock you out. And she said that most of them were having to do with love. I believe one was a birth of a child. One was drugs, but then she thought about that and she sort of dismissed it and said, maybe that doesn't count. And she said, if an angel came down and offered her another experience of joy right now, she would probably say no. And the reason she gave was because it was too destabilizing, too disorienting. It sort of made the rest of her life look ashen outside of it. And I remember reading that and thinking, I know just what that is because I've experienced it. And I think it's because joy, these moments that you're talking about, ask something of us. There's a theologian, Jürgen Moltmann, who says compassion is the other side of the living joy. In that instance, you come out of an experience of joy and it ought to make you wonder, well, why doesn't everybody get to feel this?
Right.
What do I do for others to make them feel it? And or it makes you think, why doesn't life contain more of these moments? Why does it make the rest of my life look so ashen? And what do I do about that? And I think for C.S. Lewis, he pointed out those moments where he experienced joy, and that's what led him to Christianity, where remembering joy, these moments of absolute joy when the universe seemed unified and his existence within it. It all seemed integrated. And he came to the conclusion that these were instances of the presence of God, and that you have to in some way be faithful to those moments after you leave them. Maybe that's what faith is being faithful to those moments rather than something else, faith towards something in the future.
And that is also true of despair.
In what sense?
In the sense, you put it here that people who've been away from God, this is a quote, tend to come back by one of two ways, extreme lack or extreme love, an overmastering sorrow or a strangely disabling joy. I think that's disabling joy. Either the world is not enough for the hole that has opened in you, or it's too much.
Yeah. Yeah, I think either one of those, it is a mirror image. I think suffering and joy do mirror each other's in some way. There's a wonderful quote by Richard Wilbur at the end of a poem called Hamlin Brook, and he's looked at this beautiful river or brook that he's described throughout the whole poem. And at the end, he says, joy's trick is to supply dry lips with what can cool and slake, leaving them dumbstruck also with an ache nothing can satisfy. And that's what C.S. Lewis was talking about. You're suddenly conscious of a homesickness for a home that you didn't know you had. And it makes you want to find that home. It makes you want to do something with that experience of joy. But suffering is the same. Suffering cuts us open, and it renders us completely vulnerable to the world in ways that we usually aren't. I mean, people criticize people when they turn to God in times of suffering. But if you think about it, I mean, it takes a hell of a lot just to like change your coffee consumption or drink one drink less a night or something. I mean, if you're going to change your whole existential relation to the universe, it might take quite a big hammer blow.
Right, right. And faith is ubiquitous, right? It's. I mean, you put it this way: the question of faith, which is ultimately separate from the question of religion, is the single most important question that any person asks in and of her life, and that every life is an answer to this question, whether she has addressed it consciously or not. In other words, we all have some kind of working definition of reality, of metaphysics that we have to have as conscious beings, because we're both aware of ourselves and our life, and also death, and also what we do not know and cannot know. And so that redirects you. And at the same time, so I mean, despair is not, I think you're right, despair and joy points you beyond where you are. It suggests a larger context, which you kind of are aware of, but haven't fully faced. And it strikes me that, and suffering obviously is a crucial part of that too, or can be a crucial part of it. Do you think that the way the modern world has been constructed, the way it has, certainly in the West, sort of really rendered us incredibly safe and incredibly comfortable and incredibly secure from these very deep, dark questions? At one point in the book, you point out, you know, how we push the old and the dying away from us. Like, we don't want to see, they're in some special place that we don't observe. We don't want to see ourselves crumbling and dying. And facing that actually helps you face the reality of where you are.
Oh, absolutely. I do think we've managed to live in a kind of vacuum sealed, it's like a climate-controlled happiness, in which paradoxically many people feel despair.
And distraction, too.
Constant
short-term distraction.
Yeah.
That's what the internet really is. It's this incredible distraction machine.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just, yeah. It's as if this, I always feel like there is some mass that is trying to swallow us all the time. And it's just this mass of shitty thought, noise, political nonsense. It's like the annihilation of consciousness, of any chance of individual consciousness. I think that's, you mentioned Pascal, his most famous saying, you know, is that all the problems in the world could be solved if someone could sit alone, if we could sit alone in a room for an hour with ourselves. And that's it, actually. That's the problem, is the despair comes from, we all feel our individual consciousness eradicated and no chance for the expression of an individual soul. And for me, that's one of the most important things poetry can do, is that it can provide these moments of clarity in which you can breathe apart from all that noise.
Or meditation, obviously, is a way of doing this. And prayer too, if we understand prayer to be, if one understands that prayer is not, dear God, here is my list of shit right. I need to get done.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the classic, or even asking questions like that at all. It is at its best silence. Have you seen the film Into Great Silence, Die große Stille? Which is about the monastery of Chartreuse in the Alps, silent denomination of monks, and Philip Groening was the director, and he went, it was allowed in, no one's ever allowed in, and he did a 3-hour film of extraordinary footage, in which the first 2 3/4 hours have no words at all. You literally walk into a movie theater, as I did, and suddenly, I was late, I remember, and I got in there, and I, as I was sitting down with my popcorn or whatever, I realized this place is dead silent. Everybody was kind of silenced by their silence. And then you suddenly are able to see things more clearly and observe things more carefully. And the silence that is in the liturgies, or the silences that is implied in the pauses in poetry, these things are moments for reflection, for contemplation.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a critic, R.P. Blackmore, who talks about metaphor in poetry, where it increases the amount of reality available to us. It doesn't increase reality, but it simply makes more reality available to us. And that's similar to that film you're talking about. I love Terrence Malick in the same way.
Yeah, of course.
I'm in awe of what he is able to do.
Well, he's able to produce awe, right?
He is able to produce awe, yeah. And really what he's doing is he's refreshing the world so that you see it again. It's in those moments of absolute physicality in his films, when he focuses on an object or something from nature or a face, and the kind of depth that he brings out of that, it really is uncanny. Just uncanny.
If I were asked, like, moments in my life where I became aware of the presence of God, which aren't that many, which happened quite rarely, but I do remember one. It was completely unexpected. Walking into the grounds of New College, Oxford, as an undergraduate, and seeing a couple of daffodils that had just bloomed. And all I can say is I saw that and I was transfixed. I mean, I'm kind of Wordsworth, I guess. But for a moment, it seemed like eternity was there. That there was something completely transcendent. Time had changed itself suddenly. And I could just see this in a timeless way as forever.
Yeah.
And it was that was one of those moments where everything else faded away. And I saw that reality, which was a kind of eternal reality, in this simple, simple physical flower.
Yeah. And it's not as if you're seeing an unreality. It's as if you're finally seeing reality.
Yes.
Seeing something as it is. It's like if we could truly see, we could see that all the time. The world is like that all the time. It's just that our eyes are so clouded and our ears so muffled that it just very rarely breaks through.
And that's what people tell you about psychedelic drugs, is that they also manage to suspend temporarily and not by act of will, but by chemical reactions, they actually sustain a moment where you can see more things. It's not like you're distorting your vision. It is as if you've taken off some sort of mesh in front of your eyes that allows you to see more and experience more. And in those experiences, people do sense something like the divine or something transcendent, put it that way.
Yeah. Have you done it?
Yes. And I have felt those things. I honestly, my friends make a lot of fun of me for this, but if they give me MDMA, I disappear off and think about the incarnation. I literally did it at a dance club once, at a rave club. I was given a little too much ecstasy. I disappeared off into a dark corner, sat on a stool and looked at the floor and just contemplated what it meant to be Jesus as God and man. And it went on for a long time. It is as if it broke down the barriers of the things that I really was grappling with underneath. I had an epic experience on magic mushrooms once where I literally, and I thought about this in your book actually, because it just felt to me I was having an argument in my soul between Jesus and Nietzsche. I know this sounds incredibly pretentious, but having been fascinated by Nietzsche, and obviously it struck me this there was something real in the struggle and that I had to resolve it somehow. And I did. In my heart, I trusted Jesus over Nietzsche. You, of course, and this is an interesting part of the book, you kind of like Nietzsche.
And
you think
like
of Nietzsche as a sort of entryway to faith in a way.
Yeah, I do like him. I mean, Nietzsche was what drove me away from faith when I was in college, but I sort of read him shallowly, I think. But I think Nietzsche's on the side of the angels. He's tearing away false gods, and the God that I had at that time needed to be torn away. And he did the job, scoured it away.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? What God did he scramble?
The God that you can speak about with propositions, the God that is at the head of all religions, the God that is somehow translated from that experience of those flowers into doctrine.
Yeah.
That God. But Nietzsche spoke about, everything we've said here about joy and suffering is from Nietzsche. I mean, he said these very things. He spoke about tragic joy, and he spoke about no creativity exists without suffering. And I think you understood completely what we were saying about those experiences leading to existential clarity and existential excess. He wouldn't have ever attributed a God in that excess, but he would have said that it was an absolute reality, that you were getting to some absolute reality, and that was the nature of joy. And there was a notion of eternity in Nietzsche. He wasn't by any means a materialist. There was a notion.
Eternal return.
Yeah, yeah. And he thought that joy was an indication of eternity, that it suggested that some sort of eternal state. So yeah, I find Nietzsche and other people like him, E.M. Chorin's a Romanian philosopher that I've found very helpful. He's more grumpy than Nietzsche, but I like him. Once I was at a Catholic university, and I quoted E.M. Chorin to them, and there's a passage where he says he wishes he could have been a cannibal, not for the pleasure of eating people, but for the pleasure of vomiting them out. see, I thought that was very funny too, but they didn't think it was funny. They didn't think it was funny at all, but that seems to me funny. And somebody who says that
it is funny.
Yeah, I think they're. He
made me
laugh.
Several things he said are hilarious. I want to get back to suffering though, because suffering also is something that happened to you when you were dealing with cancer. You have been tell us a little bit just roughly how long you've been dealing with this really incredibly tenacious cancer. The unlikelihood of you being alive today is quite high, really, right? I mean, you've sort of defied the odds. Can you just give us a brief summary of your long struggle in this twilight zone?
Yeah, so 18 years ago, when I was 39, I was diagnosed. I was in great health. I ran 6 miles a day, often much further than that, and was, you know, extremely fit. But I was diagnosed with this in a routine checkup. I had a tiny, tiny little lymph node, and that turned into a blood cancer, very rare blood cancer. And yeah, I've gone through 19 years. I've had 12 major treatments, and meaning 12 treatments when the cancer was out of control and they had to do something, and including a bone marrow transplant, including this past spring, what's called CAR T cell therapy. It's another form of transplant where they genetically re-engineer your cells and put them back in your body. And I've been almost dead 3 times. I thought for sure I wouldn't see this book published, because last spring it was really over, and this is a brand new treatment. I was the first person in the country with my disease to get this treatment, and it worked. So yeah, my wife and I have lived for our whole marriage. I got diagnosed 8 months after we got married, so we've spent our whole marriage on this knife edge, really.
It's obviously, you say at one point here in the book, and I'll read it, "I am a Christian because once when I was suffering terribly and near death, Christ came to me. In my mind, in my heart, through the minds and hearts of others, through what I was reading and what I was touching and tasting and seeing, he seemed everywhere, damn it, and was present in my soul, was my soul." That's an extraordinary thing to say. And one wonders if it's possible to ever experience that without enduring a kind of existential suffering that pushes you, your face right up to the window pane of oblivion and keeps you there.
Yeah, maybe. I would hope it's possible in joy that some people could experience that.
Get rid of pride, right? And joy can sometimes be accompanied with pride.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point.
Suffering, you're just stripped of everything and you realize you've got nothing.
Yeah.
And everything's been taken away. And and that's when you realize, well, that's what life is. That's where we are, these creatures at the edge of an insignificant galaxy in this giant universe. And we don't know.
Yeah, bare forked creatures. Yeah, I do think that, yeah, we do walk around as if we're striding the earth and in control of our lives, and our egos are massive. And you're right. It takes a big blow to reduce us to our essential self, what we really are. And I mean, it's bizarre to say that you're grateful for that, but I have a poem in this book that ends with being grateful for my losses. And I think I have come to terms with that in some way. I am grateful for that experience. I'm grateful for that experience in Chicago that you just quoted about in that book. But there was another, this past March, I had 2 friends. I had to be in Boston for 5 weeks to get this treatment. And I could never be alone because the neurological side effects are severe. And I had 2 friends come and stay with me. And during that time, and one is a Jewish Buddhist and friend, I've been friends with her for 35 years or something. And the other also, the 35-year friendship, that is a person, a fiction writer, but very alert to and sensitive to mystery, but not a person of religious faith at all. And I was struck by how utterly close we were able to be with each other, how intimate we were. And it was because everything was just stripped away. I was suffering so bad, and they were suffering so bad because of what they felt for me. And it seemed to me that Christ was very much with us very much expressed within our relationships, even though neither of those people would call themselves a Christian at all. And this is why I feel that Christ is much larger than Christianity, and that Christ is alive outside of Christianity. It's the great mistake, I think, that Christianity makes, is confining the attempt to confine God, the attempt to confine Jesus within the strictures of the religion. It drives me nuts.
How would you counter the point that people would make was, well, you're just inventing this stuff to make yourself feel better. You're just too weak to contemplate the meaninglessness of existence. And you're frightened because you are in pain and you could well be dying soon. And therefore, you've concocted this entire imaginary world in your head that will help you feel better. Tell me how you would, I'm putting it in a slightly facetious way or in a slightly ugly way, but let's think of that put in the nicest possible way. How do you respond to it? Because it's clear to me that this wasn't you creating this. It happened to you. And that's a very important distinction.
Well, it would be impossible for anyone to make that argument any stronger than I've made it to myself. I mean, I am a severe critic and severe doubter of my own experience, and I've fallen away from it. And I've gone through times when I do think that. I do think, oh, you're just, you know, you concocted all that in your head. But two reasons, I guess. For one, the experience is overwhelming, and you're a fool if you are so close to the world that you no experience can change you. And if you're going to doubt every single experience that comes along and nothing can reach you, then I think you're a fool. But I have also lived into that faith as well as I am able. And I have done what I have tried to do, what I suggested needs to be done after an instance of joy or suffering, that you try to be faithful to that moment to figure out what in the hell it was and to give it some form in the rest of your life. You're never going to be able to say definitively, it's real. This happened and it's absolutely real, and fuck you, you know, if you don't believe it. It just doesn't work like that. It's tenuous. And I've tried to live in honor of it. And I fall away from it, but that's the best you can do, I think.
I have had very similar experiences in a way. I mean, I had been a conventional Catholic, as it were, sort of. I'm more than a conventional. I was intellectually very wired up to be a Catholic. I think it's partly because I was born in a Protestant country and wanted to show them whatever, and believed it to a great extent, and practiced very conscientiously. But I don't think I ever really encountered Christ until I was given a terminal, well, not terminal, very severe diagnosis of AIDS when I was 29 years old and was surrounded by other people at the time, which is what made it an interesting experience, who were going through exactly the same thing. And as I was experiencing that, I was nursing my closest friend to death. And it was then that the world opened and I saw stuff and I felt stuff and I heard stuff. I heard a voice. It sounded like my voice, but it wasn't my voice. I knew that much. And it was in that being pressed into that reality that we will all die, that we're here for a short period of time, and that I'm just being presented with this fact in a very dramatic, early, out-of-the-way mold of most people. But he came to me, and I heard it. And I felt it, and it rescued me. And I, again, when I look back and I think, was I just hallucinating? Was I just in such a state of distress that I reached for anything? As you say, at some point, I just have to say, no, it wasn't. But at some point, I had to change my life to make that resonant.
Yeah. Well, I think you realize, too, that it would be a deep betrayal to let that experience go, to say that it was okay, it's nothing, I've lost faith in that, it would just be a really deep betrayal and unforgivable, really. And so I can't do it. I mean, this is the way I'm going to live until I die.
And suffering does this. You have some beautiful quotes of others in here. There's Aeschylus, 2,500 years ago, saying, "Pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despite, against our will, comes wisdom to us from the awful grace of God." Or Rumi, "The wound is the place where the light enters you." Or Montaigne, another, well, I wouldn't call him a religious, deeply religious person, but someone who was very much in touch with the human condition, "A man who fears suffering is already suffering from what he fears." It's rather brilliant. Or, you know, we can think of Leonard Cohen. "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in."
Yeah. I was thinking of Simone Weil when you were talking about these moments that tear you open. She says, "Time rends the soul. Through the rent, eternity enters," which I think is beautiful. Time tears us up, but through those torn places, eternity enters.
And eternity, let's talk about that for a second, because I think that word... Hi there. This is not the end of this podcast. In fact, we're only just getting going. If you're a paid subscriber and are hearing this, it means you haven't yet signed up for the full new package to get our podcast in full. No extra charge. Just go to andrewsullivan.substack.com/listen, LISTEN, and make sure your podcast is up to date with the Dishcast. You'll be able to add it to your Dishcast feed and never have this hear this message again, and go back to exactly what you've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'd like to thank you, too, for contributing for so long. If you're hearing this message and you haven't yet subscribed and want to listen to the rest of the podcast, then just subscribe. It's very easy. andrewsullivan.substack.com is $50 a year. Great value for money. And you also get with that the entire weekly dish every Friday. Not just my weekly column, but also all the comments and dissents on that column. You also have a full discussion of the previous week's Dishcast. So all those questions you had in your mind can be answered, or you can hear and read readers debating what we talked about, sometimes calling me to account. andrewsullivan.substack.com. Subscribe and get the whole thing. Join the debate. Join the fun. Subscribe.